From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear from several artists who are calling last month's in-person primary election a crime against humanity. Then a new journaling project from the Wisconsin Historical Society seeks to show how everyday people are experiencing this pandemic.
Help us create a really strong timeline for how the pandemic happens, how it's unfolding, how people are dealing with it, and then how people kind of come out on the other side and what we're seeing after this event is over.
An anti-vaping advocate shares his experience with addiction.
Instead of school being a 7 to 8 hour period, you know, where you go to learn, where you get your work done, that was a 7 to 8 hour period where I had to hide from my teachers and hide from my peers, so people didn't see what I was doing.
Plus, an essayist compares the coronavirus pandemic to experiences during the Great Depression. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. If you've driven through the intersection of First and Pittsburgh in Walker's Point in the last few weeks, you might have seen a pretty bold statement painted onto the windows of Black Paint Studios. It says, "Wisconsin's pandemic primary was a crime against humanity." According to the latest estimates from Wisconsin's Department of Health Services, at least 67 people are likely to have contracted the coronavirus from voting in person during last month's election. The Walker's Point installation is part of a broad effort by several local artists to document and immortalize the perceived injustices of Wisconsin's electoral politics, both before and during the coronavirus outbreak. Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently spoke with some of those artists and activists, including Black Paint's creative director Katie Mullen, filmmaker Laura Kesman, and activist Dakota Hall from LIT, Leaders Igniting Transformation.
Katie Mullen, Dakota Hall, Laura Kesman, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thanks, Julian. Thank you.
Dakota, I wanted to start with you. Given your activism, this art project, it declares that the Wisconsin elections in April, the primary elections, were a, quote, crime against humanity. I wanted to get a sense of why you use that terminology. I mean, I decided to look up the definition. There's the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court. You know, people use this idea of crime against humanity. I looked up what this is, and it's murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, imprisonment, torture, grave forms of sexual violence, persecution, enforced disappearance, apartheid, and other inhumane attacks with the knowledge of the attack. So how does hosting an election during a pandemic fit into that kind of framework that people understand as crimes against humanity?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So, you know, the definition of crime against humanity that we looked at was a deliberate act that causes human suffering or death on a large scale. And everything leading up to this election pointed that this coronavirus pandemic was causing mass hospitalizations and deaths throughout the country. And in a moment in which most of the country was shut down, Wisconsin decided to go forward with an election. And that was backed up by Republicans and Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices on the national level, as well as the elected ones on the state level. And so when we think about the deliberate act of forcing people to the polls for the election, knowing that we're in a global pandemic that is causing mass hospitalizations and deaths across the world, you know, we thought that it fit the definition of a crime against humanity. They knew the pandemic was dangerous, yet they still forced people to the polls in order to have their vote cast.
You use the word forced. I mean, I think people would argue that voting is a choice. So how would you address that? You know, that people didn't have to go vote.
I mean, I think when you look at particularly communities of color who have fought for decades for the right to vote, voting is not necessarily a choice, but an act of resilience and resistance in this country, as well as, you know, many of these folks who went out to go vote were absolutely confused by the numerous law changes leading up to the election, whether it was Tony Evers' declaration and executive order that the election be postponed, the Supreme Court orderings, and even court orderings weeks leading up to the election, there was just mass confusion, as well as the Postal Service did not deliver a lot of ballots to folks. So when I say forced, literally people who wanted to go cast a ballot, who felt that it would be an injustice not to cast their ballot based on the decades of pain and suffering that their elders and ancestors had to go through to vote, were forced to the polls if to honor that legacy.
Now, I've also read, and you've cited in some of your materials, that Wisconsin already had a kind of disproportionately difficult and arcane and Byzantine electoral system. So how do you feel that compounded, or do you feel like this particular election, given the pandemic, revealed issues that were pre-existing?
Yeah, I think Wisconsin really highlighted the fact that a lot of communities, especially small rural communities, are unable to handle what it looks like to vote in a pandemic in terms of the being able to process and push out the number of absentee ballots that this state needs to. Other states like Oregon have been doing vote by mail for a decent amount of time now. And those are systems in which could help move democracy forward and help ensure that everyone can participate. And in Wisconsin, we saw that we have an inadequate system when it comes to people voting by mail. In fact, we didn't have enough envelopes to actually mail back ballots that people filled out just a few weeks before the election. So I think it really helped us expose some flaws within our election system, and hopefully can help propel us forward in terms of what does it look like to create a democracy that makes it easy for everyone to vote.
Now, Katie, as an artist, I feel like a lot of arts have historically and through different activist movements have been leveraged to point out perhaps contradictions, hypocrisies, etc. And that's a little bit of what Dakota is getting at here. There's a binary that you could either not vote and therefore not participate in a democratic process and not live out your rights as Americans are entitled to. But on the other hand, you face getting sick. So how do you, when coming up with an artistic expression of this impossible decision, or maybe not impossible because a lot of people went and voted anyway, but when you try to find inspiration in this, how do you do that?
First of all, you're absolutely right. Like about that legacy of artists being society's thought provokers and instigators. And we take that legacy so seriously and the responsibility that comes with that legacy. And, you know, about just questioning norms and addressing injustice like this pandemic election in creative ways that really, I guess, encourage others to look at things in a new light. So just art has power, right? And so what is the process of actually looking at an issue, a tough issue like this, a political or societal issue, and then coming up with a way to do that, to question that norm in a way that gets people to pay attention and maybe a way that they haven't before. And I don't have a super straightforward answer for you other than it's this combination of research. Like, we take the research side of what we do when it comes to art activism really seriously. We need to know what we're talking about. And then from the creative perspective, it's like divine inspiration. That's why I was kind of joking, like it's hard to describe. It's like you sit on something, you sit on the issue, you let it stew. And then, yeah, thunder strikes. But you know what helps is working with people like Lit, organizations like Lit who are coming at this issue from multiple perspectives. And we love Lit and we really respect what they do and have worked with them before. So they came up with a message actually for this.
Now, some people heard in the introduction what your piece is, but in your words, Katie, as an artist, how would you describe this piece that is currently on display? I think of, you know, some artists who roll their eyes when asking to explain their work because it might be more abstract, but your work isn't that abstract. It's text.
Yeah, we thought about taking a couple of different routes with it, right? Like sometimes a message that we want to send as activists is really visual, like it's conceptual, visual, and sometimes it's just a really bold font with a really bold statement. And in this case, we played with the idea of doing something more illustrative, and it couldn't be that. What Lit came up with, that message was just, it demanded bold font and to be what it is on its own. And we recognize that pretty quickly.
So it says Wisconsin's pandemic primary on one window equals crime against humanity on another window, lightning bolts, eyes. I mean, it takes up the whole window. This has probably got to be 8 feet tall.
Right. Yeah. And we really recognize, so we just moved into that building. That's actually the building where our studio is. And we just moved into that building a couple of months ago and realized right away what we had in that, what you're describing, how big those windows are, and not only how big they are, but how visible they are in the city because they sit on a really busy intersection right outside of downtown Milwaukee, like on the border of that and Walker's Point. And so it's the location. I mean, you have to stop. If you're in your car, you're stopped at that intersection, sort of stuck staring at those windows, so you can't really miss it. When we didn't have a space like this, this new space that we have, we were on the fourth floor of a warehouse building. And when we had something like this to say, which we have in the past about all kinds of issues from reproductive rights to other stuff, we would hang handmade banners out of our fourth floor windows that no one saw because it was in this warehouse district that was tucked back somewhere. But again, we recognize the power of just the location itself in getting messages like this out there, whether they just be bold text like this one demanded, or in the future, probably sometimes playing with more illustrative elements on those windows.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and you just heard from Katie Mullen, the creative director of Black Paint. They're an arts collective. Earlier, you heard from Dakota Hall, the executive director of LIT, Leaders Igniting Transformation. Now I want to ask Laura Kesman, who's joining us as well, the owner of Lion Art Media, who made a film about this art installation that's in downtown Milwaukee that calls Wisconsin's primary last month a crime against humanity. Obviously, there are limitations to how you can make a film today. You can't walk up to people necessarily in the same way as you could to interview them. How did you find the people who shared their stories of voting in the election? And what were some of your limitations that you had to take into account? And how did that play out artistically for you?
The story of how the film came together is a little less thought out than you may think. Instead of it being a premeditated, planned thing, it was more instinctual for us. So my creative partner, Bianca Fuster, were on the phone that morning just kind of talking about what was happening with the long lines. And she was trying to vote and couldn't because her absentee ballot didn't come. And instinct just took over. I mean, her and I both have, you know, journalistic backgrounds. We're both filmmakers. And so we didn't go into Tuesday, April 7th, with the plan to film. So, but to answer your question about how we found the people who spoke, obviously, you know, doing traditional interviews was not an option due to social distancing. And so, as I was out there filming, and between my partner Bianca and I, you know, we covered all five polling locations that were open in Milwaukee that day. And as I was going around and getting footage, I was, you know, striking up conversation with people in line and, you know, kind of got commitments from people for me to follow up with them and do a phone interview that evening and the next day. But yeah, I mean, so it was a very organic experience that day for us.
Now, I wanted to ask you, Laura, a little bit about the value of storytelling. I mean, as an audio journalist myself, I'm talking to people like you and expecting people to share their stories. But I want to kind of ask you something similar to what I asked Katie, in the sense that sometimes stories stand alone and sometimes the moral of a story needs to be explained. So when you share a story, how do you personally approach finding meaning in that story, and how do you expect people to take meaning away? Or do you think it stands alone being implied, like the lesson of a story being implied?
Right. That's a great question and is something that I think about all the time, you know, in this line of work. And I think for me, what was most important that day was capturing the the human element of what was happening. You know, I mean, we were, you know, pretty saturated that day with the information of the policy of what was happening, the logistics of what went wrong or what was happening. It's like we knew all of that, but what I felt was really important to capture was the moral choice, the ethic choice that people had to make that day. You know, do I go against my instinct and you know, follow what I've, you know, been told for a month, which is to stay away from people, to stay home, to be careful, to not put myself and other people in danger? Or do I exercise my right to vote, arguably at, you know, a very critical time? The last thing that I wanted to happen was for this experience to be just a drop in a bucket and get lost in the noise that we're inundated with on a daily basis. You know, particularly like being in quarantine, we're ingesting a lot of information very rapidly all the time. And this was a big deal. You know, this was a big moment, you know, for Wisconsin and arguably our country, you know, to put voters in a position like this. And I think that it's really dangerous when precedents are set like this and they're not recorded and that information isn't disseminated in a lasting way that people remember what happened.
Now, Dakota, take us out here. I wanted to get your kind of final take on this moment that we're living through. You know, I think nationally over the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, there's been a kind of an awakening. There's been probably a dozen moments where people have said, this is it, something's going to change and something's got to change. But of course, here in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, in cities that are racially segregated and economically stratified, do you think that there is something about this pandemic that really will take us over the top with regards to major social change? Or do you think that experience of, you know, Milwaukee being, you know, segregated for a century will persist?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question. I think, you know, throughout history, what we've seen is usually there is a moment in which catastrophe happens in society, whether we look at the Great Recession, 9/11, and that continuously goes back, is there's always a moment to organize for change on either side. And I think, you know, what the responsibility is to do some deep organizing and rely on the creativity, the artistry, the young people, the communities of color, to do that organizing, that deep organizing, and to be able to come out of this moment with a society that is more focused on humanity than it is profits. And, you know, though we haven't reached that moment yet, I do believe we will reach that moment in the coming months, if, you know, over the next course of the year, at least, of what does that look like for major societal change. And we have to make sure that, unlike other moments, that wherever we're talking even about bailouts or how we do stuff on the local level, is that we're not just putting money into the hands of the wealthiest, that we're not just going to put good money into the hands of corporations, but really change society to focus on people. And I think this pandemic has taught us that housing is something that is a fragile infrastructure in this country and needs to be guaranteed and provided to every human being. Similar with healthcare and education, that all these basic needs need to be met. And on the flip side of that too, the workers that are out there doing the essential jobs now are often qualified as minimum wage workers, right? And so what does that mean for us to fight for a living wage for these people who in a pandemic are labeled essential, but either in a non-pandemic time, they're labeled as minimum wage workers. So I'm hoping that we could use this moment to really galvanize support to change society to focus on humanity and people and not just corporations and profit.
So you sound pretty hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite hopeful. I think what is going to happen is you're going to have a bunch of people who have a lot of energy who are unfortunately sitting at home, and they're seeing the situation going on, and they're angry because out of this whole pandemic, most individuals, if you've been lucky enough, have received a $1,200 check, while corporations are receiving millions of dollars. They are seeing the fact that the healthcare system is broken and people are not getting the care that they need. If you're deep into news, you'll see that indigenous communities like the Navajo Nation don't have running water during this pandemic. And I think people are politicizing this moment, and rightfully so, of calling out who is not being supportive, who are the bad actors in office. And I think everyone's going to come out of this, hopefully, with a renewed energy around civic engagement and social change.
Dakota Hall is the executive director of LIT, Leaders Igniting Transformation. Also joining us was Katie Mullen, creative director of Black Paint. They're an artist collective. And Laura Kesman, the owner of Lionheart Media. They're filmmakers. Thanks so much all for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Jillian.
Katie, Dakota, and Laura spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. You can find links to the art and activism discussed at eyesopenmke.com. Coming up next, we learn about the Wisconsin Historical Society's COVID-19 journaling project. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. History is happening every day, and it's not just recorded by powerful people. This pandemic is a huge moment in our collective history, happening to all of us. And it's important that people in the future can learn about our experiences. There's perhaps no better way to do that than through firsthand accounts. In 1861, the Wisconsin Historical Society's founder, Lyman Draper, asked soldiers stationed at Camp Randall in Madison to help document the Civil War by keeping a diary. Now the Historical Society is asking the same of us through its COVID-19 journaling project. The project is seeking people of all ages to keep journals in any format, from writing in a notebook, on your computer, recording audio, or video. To learn more about it, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Simone Munson, the Wisconsin Historical Society Librarian Archives Collection Development Coordinator.
Simone Munson, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here.
So what was the first crisis the Wisconsin Historical Society worked to document in real time with everyday Wisconsinites?
You know, the Wisconsin Historical Society was founded back in 1846, and some of our founding members definitely had this idea of documenting history in real time. Probably one of our most well-known founders, his name was Lyman Draper, and he had a real interest in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, and he did research in that. So when the Civil War started brewing and things related to the Civil War started happening, he definitely saw that as an opportunity to be capturing history as it happened. And so he really encouraged soldiers that served for Wisconsin Infantry to keep journals and diaries to document their experiences in the Civil War. And really, that was the first opportunity that the Historical Society had to do this collecting in real time.
So we may think that history needs to be in books we read in school or already be a time well before our modern lives with modern technology. But what's happening right now is historical.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we often sort of take for granted that the things that we're experiencing today will one day be in history books. So the pandemic and things related to, you know, world health are definitely something that will be talked about in the future.
So what are you asking people to do now to add our voices to this historical event?
Yeah, so the Historical Society has come up with something we're calling the COVID-19 Journaling Project. And really what we're doing is we're encouraging people to keep journals in any format that they want to. It could be a traditional, you know, pen and paper kind of journal. It could be a photo journal. It could be an audio recording that they do every day, just to sort of get down the events of what is happening in the world, how people are coping with this situation that we're living in, and kind of help us create a really strong timeline for how the pandemic happens, how it's unfolding, how people are dealing with it, and then how people kind of come out on the other side and what we're seeing after this event is over.
So given that a lot of things are developing, is there a timeline for how long you want people to journal?
So the way that the project is set up is that we're hoping that people can keep a journal for 30, 60, or 90 days and go from there. Obviously, if things last longer and we need to keep journals for longer, we can do it for longer. Or if someone started a journal back in February or March, documenting those earlier days before we were all kind of told to go home, then we would love to have those kinds of entries too. If you go to our website, which is wisconsinhistory.org, there's a way that you can register for the journal project. And when you register for the journal project, we're asking people to kind of make a commitment to either 30, 60, or 90 days of journaling. And if that changes or we have to make adjustments, that's totally fine.
So what would you say to encourage people from all walks of life and jobs and current situations to participate? Perhaps someone thinks, I'm just trying to survive day to day. You know, what do I have to contribute to the bigger picture of what's happening?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that historians and archivists are always looking for is information on the experiences of everyday people. And sometimes those are harder to find than what we would like. You know, we often think of politicians and people that are involved, well-known figures, that their letters and papers and things are the things that get saved. But really, historians now are really interested in what was the experience of day-to-day life and how that was affected. The other thing I would say about this specific pandemic and kind of crisis that we're living through is that the sort of people who aren't traditionally in the limelight are suddenly getting more attention and sort of being, you know, cast into the limelight, sort of jobs and things that we don't often think of and maybe we take for granted on a day-to-day basis are becoming just vital to survival and existence. And so there's something really valuable in having the experiences from a wide spectrum of people so that we can sort of document that for future generations to understand.
There's also a lot of kids home from school, and perhaps journaling and writing might help not only take up some time and be an activity, but maybe help them process things a little bit. Are you looking for voices of all ages?
Yeah, definitely. We've begun conversations with some school teachers. There are a few teachers in the area that are doing it as a school project. So their entire class will be keeping journals for the duration of the time that they're home. And even parents that are, you know, struggling with homeschooling. I am a parent of four, and I am definitely always looking for things to come up with for my kids to do while we're home. And, you know, having them have like a quiet reflective time where they have to, you know, write for 5 or 10 minutes, or even just keep like a Word doc or something like that, where they're just writing online for 10 minutes might be a useful thing to help them process. Yeah.
So say I'm sitting down and trying to start a journal, but don't know where to begin. Do you have any helpful tips for journaling during this pandemic, especially if people don't practice writing a lot?
Well, there are some writing prompts that are listed on the website. So if you end up going to the website to register for the project, there are some writing prompts there. We're really asking people to just sort of think about their everyday life and what they did each day, how they passed the time, what they encountered, how they felt about certain news articles and things that they saw online or just, you know, heard about. But there's also like a wide variety of writing clubs and writing groups out there. So if you have access to the internet and you just, you know, Google search like a writing club, there's endless amounts of groups out there that can help you get started with writing prompts.
So what's your hope, not just in collecting stories, but for the people who will contribute to this journaling project?
Yeah, so We're sort of hoping that the journaling project will do a couple things. Like we said, that we really want to collect the stories of a wide variety of people, that we're not just hearing the same voices over and over again. So we're really hoping that, you know, all ages and professions and backgrounds will be submitting journals so that we have really a wide variety of voices in the collection. And then the other thing is that we're hoping that it does serve as like a reflective tool, that people can see this as an opportunity to sort of think about how they're doing and use the time that they're spending to write or photograph or create some sort of artistic expression in a journal to sort of help them deal with the situation that we're living in. You know, one of the pieces that we've noticed as we've worked through the project, as our staff has worked through the project, and as we've sort of been developing materials, is that there are a lot of corollaries to these big events that have happened in the past. So whether it's the Civil War soldiers who were keeping journals or the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that came through, that we're seeing that a lot of the things that happened in those moments of crisis are happening again today. And so kind of the patterns that we see in history and the human experience are really coming through.
Definitely. Well, Simone Munson, thank you so much for your time today and for initiating and helping out with this journaling project. I hope a lot of people add their voices.
Yeah, me too. Thanks so much.
Simone Munson is the Wisconsin Historical Society Librarian Archives Collection Development Coordinator. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the COVID-19 journal project. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When vape pens first came out, they were marketed as a healthier alternative to smoking. But as more research has come out about the long-term effects of vaping, it's complicated that narrative. Here in Milwaukee, the dangers of vaping came into focus when several teens were hospitalized with lung damage related to vaping. For teenager Luca Kynard, the impacts of vaping went far beyond his health. Kynard says his vaping addiction became all-consuming. His grades plummeted, his mood became erratic, and eventually he had a grand mal seizure. His addiction landed him in rehab. Now Kynard talks to groups of students about the dangers of vaping. Before the pandemic, Kynard was scheduled to speak with students at Milwaukee area schools through FACT, a Wisconsin-based anti-tobacco organization. Instead, Kynard is speaking with students virtually. He joins me from his home in North Carolina, and we're also joined by Nia Camera, one of the co-founders of the FACT group at Shorewood High School. Nia, Luca, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, no problem.
So, Luca, you describe yourself as a former teen vaping addict. Of course, you're also a current teenager, but what was it about vaping that you initially found attractive?
When I was first doing it, I was 14 years old and I was a freshman in high school. For me, the first time ever doing it was a ticket to the front row seats at a football game. It was kind of easy access to have a connection with somebody in high school. You know, I see somebody in the crowd and they have a vape and I do too. We automatically have something in common. So for me, it was just an easy middle ground to start a relationship with somebody, or a friendship, if you will.
Yeah, you know, as I was going through, you know, some of the information about your life, you say it really impacted your schoolwork. You went from being an A student to an F student, and it had this really transformative impact on who you were. What was it about this addiction that caused this pretty drastic change?
It was definitely my focus had changed, you know. Instead of school being a 7 to 8 hour period, you know, where you go to learn, you have a few classes in between where you get your work done. That was a 7 to 8 hour period where I had to hide from my teachers and hide from my peers. So people didn't see what I was doing. I was constantly hiding. So instead of, you know, in the classroom, focusing on my work, I'd be focusing more on, is the teacher going to catch me? Or when I go home, I'd be more worried about how I'm going to get my fix and where I'm going to do it instead of really doing my work, which is the exact opposite of what I used to do. I used to be a straight A student. So it's just completely, my focus had changed entirely.
Yeah, you can't really vape in front of people. I mean, it's different from cigarettes, of course. The smell is different. The ability to do it in different places is different. But still, you can't really do it in front of teachers. What was a regular day like for you when you were addicted to vaping?
A regular day for me, you know, wake up at 6:45 or 7 in the morning, and first thing I do is get my morning buzz. I would sit there and I would hit it a few times, and then I would go downstairs. I would eat my food, you know, brush my teeth, and then I would have maybe 15 minutes left before I got to go to school. And I would sit there outside of my window looking out at the street, and I would hit it. And then I would go to school. School for the first maybe 15 minutes was out in the courtyard about to go into class. And I'd sit there going around to all the cars in the senior parking lot trying to get people's vapes to hit. And then I go to class. That's when the day is really hectic for me, because I'm constantly trying to get something to hit. If I didn't have my own, going in and out of the bathroom, head down in the class, falling asleep, staying awake. And then I walk home from school doing the same thing when I'm walking home. And then when I get home, first thing I do is I barricade myself in my room, and I start vaping for the rest of the night until I leave the house. That was my typical day.
So this is something that was really consuming most of your life. And, you know, we already talked about the fact it had a big impact on who you were emotionally, how you were doing in your schoolwork. But there were also physical impacts of this addiction. How did it impact you physically?
There was many different physical changes that happened to my body at that time. You know, nicotine is a stimulant, so it's keeping you awake, and that's what I would use it for. I would say I was doing it for my homework, but really I was just trying to catch up on whatever social media I was on, or just staying up for whatever reason. And, you know, the only time you grow during the day is when you're asleep. So when you're staying up every single night, you know, and only getting 2 to 3 hours of sleep, you're not growing. So my growth is stunted. I stayed the same height, same weight. But when I went to rehab for 39 days, not 39 days, I grew 2 inches and I gained 10 pounds. So just that alone was a change. I also had a seizure from vaping for 6 minutes. It was a grand mal seizure. It's the only seizure I've ever had. Never had one before, never had one after. And I also had an inflamed chest wall from vaping.
Wow. So, you know, you mentioned you had a seizure. For you, was that the final straw?
No, it was not the final straw. My attitude at the time about the seizure was, leave me alone about it. You know, people were constantly asking me, how's my health, and genuinely concerned and interested about what was going on with me. I really pushed that away. So for the next 2 months of my life, I just pushed everybody away. I really didn't want anybody to see me, talk to me. It really just sparked me just to go down a worse path at the time, just because of my poor attitude. But the last straw was when I went to rehab 2 months later.
Did your parents make you go to rehab?
They sure did. Yeah. They told me the night before, pack your bags, you're going to go to rehab for 8 days in California. When I got there to rehab, however, I was told, you know, you're going to be here 35 to 45 days, or you can be here for 90. So I automatically knew that they had lied to me about it being 8 days. Thankfully, they did, though, because they knew I would never have gotten on that plane if I had known how long it was going to be. So 8 days, we're just going to call that a little sprinkle of a lie.
Well, now you've become an advocate, of course, and we're joined in this conversation by Nia Camera, who's from right around here in the Milwaukee area. Vaping is not something that is, of course, site-specific. It's something that we're dealing with in high schools throughout the country. Nia, what is vaping like at your high school?
That's a good question. So vaping at my school, I would define it as crazy, because literally, like, I cannot go to the bathroom without smelling like vape, or without seeing four legs in a stall. At my school, at Sherwood High School, a lot of kids do vaping, whether it's in the bathroom, the library, sneaking in a classroom. I would call it a distraction to learning, because kids just vape. They think it's cool. Literally in class, well, when we were in class, I was walking into my comp for college class, and all I saw saw was like a jewel pod on the floor, and I was like, hey, this is not cool. So vaping is just really not good.
Tell us a bit about this organization that you helped found at your school, FACT.
So FACT is a group that spreads the truth about tobacco for 7th through 12th graders. We do these activities called Factivism, where we take a fact about tobacco and it has activism in them. So my friends, the founders, we at first started this group in like Milwaukee, the Milwaukee area. And then we were like, hey, we should like literally move this to our school. And so we decided to do FACT at our school, at Sherwood High School.
So this is really a question for both Unia and Luca. What are some of the things that people just fundamentally misunderstand about specifically vaping versus cigarettes, but tobacco use in general?
To answer the first question about what they miss about vaping compared to smoking is a lot of people believe that vaping is better than smoking. Unfortunately, there's this big belief that vaping does not have nicotine in it, when in fact it does. And even if there's a no nicotine product, even if there's a no nicotine vape juice, which there are, it's still dangerous for the fact of there's so many different things that go into it. You know, the chemicals that are used, the metal alloys are going into your lungs. So I think that's the biggest thing that people miss is that vaping is safer than tobacco. None of it's safe. And just because something is safer does not mean that it is safe. That's the biggest thing that they would miss.
Yeah, and also to go on from what Luca said, people, like my friends, they believe like it's cleaner and safer than smoking a cigarette because all you have to do is like charge it and just smoke it. They just think it's like safer and cleaner than smoking a regular cigarette.
Again, this is a question for both of you. Do you feel like there's a lot of pushback from other teenagers, from other students, when you talk to them about these dangers?
Do you mean like they don't believe, like when we say like it's bad?
Yeah, they maybe don't believe you. They maybe get, you know, defensive about why it is healthier.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Yes, absolutely. Gosh, there are so many like prime examples I could share with you. They're incredible. So I've spoken to countless schools across the United States, and I've sat there and had kids tell me to my face, you know, somebody who vapes versus somebody who doesn't vape, their lungs would be better if they were vaping. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know? So there's definitely this huge like cult following of people who vape. So yeah, there's a lot of pushback. I think a lot of it is stemmed from people are afraid because it's like, you know, my nicotine effects or my addiction might be taken away from me. So I think it's just a lot of fear of losing out on it.
Also going on from what Luca said, I would say totally yes. Because like, even when I tell my friends, like, vaping is dumb and it's really like not healthy, they still say, oh, I don't really care. Like, it's fine. Nothing's happened to me. Like, they don't believe.
You know, both of you have spoken with other students in your lives and students at other schools as well. What do you think is some of the most convincing information, the convincing facts that you bring with you that make people believe, you know, maybe this isn't so safe, maybe this isn't so good?
So for one of my projects, for one of my classes, it was a persuasive presentation that we had to give, and I did a presentation on like why Juul is bad and you shouldn't do it. And at first when I did it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so stupid. No one's going to believe me. And so I provided like statistics on Juul. And then the main like point of view in the presentation was vaping and e-cigs. Is like some of the devices can like blow up. And I provided videos of e-cigs devices blowing up in like people in my class were like, wow, I did not know that could happen. So some of them, but not all of them, were like persuaded about e-cigs.
Wow, so having them blow up, that's what said to them, oh, maybe these aren't safe.
Yeah.
For me, when I present, you know, I go through my whole story with addiction, very, very in-depth. But I think, you know, what really gets people drawn to it, maybe changes a lot of their minds, that really I talk about the stuff that people don't want to talk about, which is our emotions and our feelings, which is the last thing a teenager wants to deal with. It's really something we kind of run away from as humans, but especially as teenagers. It's because it's figuring out who you are, which is a really uncomfortable thing. And I talk about those emotions that are tied into it, you know, talking about how when I was doing it, I was so ashamed and I felt like I was a mistake because I was making mistakes, and how like progressively throughout it, I started to find really who I was and, you know, be more comfortable in my own skin. So I guess it's that kind of shedding your skin and really just shining at the end of it. I think that's a lot of what really brings a lot of attention to my story from teenagers.
Yeah. Well, Luca, Nia, thank you both so much for joining me from both of your homes and talking about this issue.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Luca Kynard is a student and anti-vaping advocate, and Nia Camera is one of the founders of FACT at Shorewood High School. Kynard was scheduled to tour Milwaukee area schools to talk to students about his experience with vaping addiction. These talks were moved online in light of school closures due to this pandemic. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Joy Powers. The coronavirus pandemic is in some ways an echo of our history. People have compared it to other health crises, like the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. Others have compared concerns about an economic downturn to what happened during the Great Depression. For essayist Aleta Chacek, these parallels were borne out in letters from her grandfather, a business owner who lived through the Great Depression. Her essay, titled "We Have Managed, So Far," begins with a passage from one of her grandfather's letters written during the Great Depression.
"We have been having bad times here in America, but we have managed so far. There are 12 to 13 million good laborers unemployed. During the past years, the entire government has been badly governed. I think it will be a long time to get the country back on an even keel." The words jump off the page as I read the letter my grandfather wrote home to his brother in Norway in September of 1933. I'm struck by the parallel of his thoughts then with an America drowning in reports of how the COVID-19 pandemic is ravaging our healthcare system and our economic engines. I reread his letter with new eyes. "Since Safer at Home was declared, I spend much of my time connecting with people I would ordinarily see when socializing, exercising, worshiping, and volunteering. My husband and I follow closely the well-being of our families who are working and going to school from home. Life goes on, and yet somehow we are mentally exhausted at the end of the day. Why is that? Is it the constant reports of numbers of confirmed cases and death from COVID-19? Is it the unending he said, she said from governmental leaders that wears me down? My heart breaks seeing images of exhausted and poorly equipped healthcare workers. But why is it so heavy for me? It's not my family. Maybe it's the woman I know whose husband died from COVID-19. Or the friends whose nurse daughter wears garbage bags taped together because her hospital has run out of gowns. Or the distraught church member's cries over a relative who has died without the comfort of family. Or the toddler grandson who cannot understand that the image of his birthday cake is too far away to actually eat. When my grandfather wrote, "We have managed so far," as he did frequently in his long letter, was he whistling in the dark or was he confident so far? My grandfather could recite the ways in which his world had changed, how much money and land he had lost. But he could also see he had a responsibility to use what resources he had well. He went on to write of the employee he will keep on as long as he can, of the support of his family here, of his concern for his distant family in Norway. He gave a local family with an unemployed dad $5 a week from his reduced earnings because he cannot, in his words, let them starve. Even though our world has shrunk to our homes and neighborhoods, we can both see and talk to people around the globe. But that does not mean we know how to cope with day-to-day challenges. What if we have no internet connection? How does our daughter work when the daycare is closed? When will I be able to see my doctor, get my teeth cleaned, my hair cut? How to manage seems to change daily. Sometimes the only answer is, we just don't know. As disrupted as our society is by slowing down, imposing limits on everyone, there is evidence that people are coming together to appreciate one another. We can't provide PPE to overtaxed healthcare workers, but we can cheer for them. We can donate to local food programs. We can appreciate our mail person, our sanitation workers. Most of all, we can stay at home and not become patients ourselves. Just as in the Great Depression, some people will get through this time and be stronger for it. Others will add burdens of unemployment, fractured relationships, diseases, and death to already fragile lives and succumb to despair. Not everyone will survive. It is likely that without some dramatic societal intervention, those who entered this time with the fewest resources will pay the highest price. During the 1990s, a time when the future of my grandfather's business, started in 1931, was very much in doubt, my brother Mark became the owner-operator. Not only has he kept the business going, he has grown it to a chain of stores where many fourth-generation family members participate in its operations. Today, that business is being stressed once again. Like his grandfather before him, Mark does not know how this will end. Selling appliances is considered an essential service, but sales are way down. Contractors are not bidding. Inventory must be maintained, and employees paid, all while ongoing expenses continue. He has laid off only 10% of his employees for now. He is paying health insurance for his remaining employees. His resilience is being tested, but so far, he is managing. Where do we get hope in this uncertain time of COVID-19? Each of us must look for it in ourselves, our family, and our communities. For me, I leave you with Grandpa's words, written long ago. I think you are getting tired of reading about all this misery. I have to tell you, it is twice as bad as I'm able to describe it in a letter. But once again, I want to say, I haven't lost my spirit. There will surely be sunshine one day again. We are managing so far.
Aletta Chasek is an author living in Milwaukee. You can find more of her work at wuwm.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. And please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.